Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Hey, warm welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here with you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in to Faith Radio. Love having you around in the afternoons. I love being here. I hope you've had a good day so far. It is all of Tuesday already, and you know how these weeks go by so fast, and summer just clips along, and before you know it, it's going to be fall. So let's take advantage of every one of these nice days. I did hear out in the Southwest they are reaching temperatures of 120-something in the desert. Doesn't it usually get to 120 in the desert in the summertime? Ah, you know, doesn't seem all that hot. So we have a great show today. We've got Rob Bluey coming up from the Daily Signal. He's the editor-in-chief, the big cheese over there. And then we're going to talk to Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition. And then a special treat in hour two, we're going to speak with Dr. Larry Crabb. And I first met Larry, I don't know, 30-some years ago. And I just thought he was so interesting. And now I get to interview him on the show, so it's going to be really fun. His latest book is called When God's Ways Make No Sense. So we're going to talk about the struggle of trusting. So that's an hour you're not going to want to miss. You don't want to miss any of it. But how are you at saving money? Have you ever tried to do something to try to save money and it just didn't work? I tried doing some of my own dentistry. Trickier than I thought. I got to be honest. I did not save any money on doing that. But if you have a great surefire way to save a few bucks, and it's tried and tested and proven, text it to me, 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. I'd love some good tips on saving some money, because that'd be good to share with our listeners as well. As always, I love a million voices sharing scripture on the show, so let's hear from Sarah. I believe this is out of Joshua.
Joshua 1:7-9. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear, simply because your program came on when you had an appointment, you were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
Welcome to the show. As you know, my weekly call with Rob Bluey is always one of my highlights. And direct from Washington, D.C., editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal, Rob Bluey. Hello, Rob.
It's great to be with you, Bill.
Thank you so much. Now, I just had to laugh because I was looking at President Trump's immigration policies. And as they're being constantly criticized by the Democrats, it did kind of had me reflect on the fact, I mean, heaven is kind of a walled community and it has an extreme vetting process.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought of that one before.
Hell,
but
it kind of has open borders, doesn't it?
Certainly. What a way to put it. Well, you know, it's one of those things where it seems like immigration is one of those issues, Bill, that we're never going to solve here in Washington, D.C., despite everyone's stated intention to try to do so. Obviously, the president wants to build that wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, and there's going to be another opportunity here in the next couple of months, and you'll expect to hear a debate on this because they have to fund the government by the end of September.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, you can expect that immigration and the border wall will be a sticking point for Republicans and Democrats. So we'll see if anybody uses your analogy this time around.
All right. Now, the Democrats, it seems like when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh getting nominated, it seems that they're always constantly shifting, moving the goalposts around. What's the latest?
Yeah, it certainly seems that they are. And one of the other things that they're doing is they're trying to find a message that sticks, because right now not a whole lot is sticking to Brett Kavanaugh. He seems to be enjoying, in fact, one of the least contentious confirmation battles. There's so much other news dominating the headlines. You're just not even seeing Kavanaugh show up on the front page when you would expect, with something at stake at this level, you'd expect there just to be a little bit more intensity. So the latest thing comes down to the documents. Senate Democrats are refusing to meet with Brett Kavanaugh until they get an agreement from Republicans on the documents. Now, Brett Kavanaugh was already confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is often described as the second most important court in America, in 2006. And this came after he served in the Bush White House. This is the George W. Bush White House. And after Democrats at the time examined a wealth of his records. Now, for the past 12 years, he's been on this court and he's made over 300 decisions. Republicans say, look, you've already had a chance to look at the White House records last time. Why do you need all of this information yet again? You have 12 years worth of court records. That's the thing that you probably are going to be more likely to judge him on anyways. And so this is where you just continue to see the goalposts shifting. And I think it's a tactic on the part of the Democrats to delay things and hopefully run this out, perhaps with the ultimate goal of pushing this past Election Day, in which point Republicans could have a lame duck Congress and might not necessarily have the votes that they do today.
Safe to say the Democrats are nervous about the Roe v. Wade and what that might have down the road?
That's one of the arguments that you're hearing. So the arguments you hear now, primarily it's the argument that Trump nominated Kavanaugh because he will vote to protect Trump because he believes in executive privilege and the power of the executive branch. I'd say secondary arguments are Roe v. Wade. Definitely hearing a lot of that from the pro-abortion group, saying that he is going to be the decisive vote. There's first of all, no indication that he is. There's only one justice on the U.S. Supreme Court who has stated quite clearly his opposition to Roe, and that's Clarence Thomas. We don't know how some of the other conservatives are going to vote on that because they've never considered the question. And Kavanaugh is unlikely to give you an answer in his confirmation hearing. So that's a secondary issue. And then I'd say a tertiary issue is the health care law. So Kavanaugh is somebody who's ruled on this in the past. Obviously, it had to go through the D.C. Circuit when he was serving as a judge before it reached the Supreme Court before. And there is some clamoring on the left that he could be the decisive vote on Obamacare. So, but here's the thing, Bill. This is why I say nothing appears to be sticking. The Democrats keep shifting away from some of these arguments when it seems that there's really nothing there, because as Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself said in her own confirmation hearing under Bill Clinton's administration, it's not appropriate to state the answers to these questions before it's posed in a court case before the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, I know, Rob, that religious persecution is getting to be more and more of an issue. Is there something going on in Washington this week with Mike Pompeo about a conference on religious freedom?
There is, yes.
Is it happening
you might
this week?
Remember, it is happening this week, and it's marking, this 20 years ago there was a religious freedom legislation, and it's marking the anniversary of this legislation. It's the first time the State Department is doing anything like this. And yes, Mike Pompeo and former U.S. Senator Sam Brownback, who's now an ambassador for the State Department on the issue of international religious freedom, are doing things. We're having an event at the Heritage Foundation on Thursday, and there was the first event took place yesterday, and the Daily Signal covered it, and encourage your listeners to go to dailysignal.com to find more on our coverage. Look, this is one of those issues that is so important that we highlight, and it's really remarkable that we haven't done this before in a more public way. This is, you know, Christians are being persecuted. People of all religious faiths across this globe are being persecuted in ways that are just unimaginable to people living in the United States. And I think bringing attention and highlighting this issue for the American people and hopefully for people across the globe is a welcome change that the Trump administration is doing.
Yeah, Rob, this is a first time ever conference on religious persecution, but they have some victims tell their stories at this conference, and there's some pretty powerful stories being told.
That's right, and that's the piece that I referenced at the Daily Signal that we covered yesterday.
Yeah.
So to kick off the week, they did have some individuals, and you know, look, Bill, I mean, these are moving stories and incredible. You know, in one case, you know, we highlighted Auschwitz and then what Nazi Germany was doing. And I think you can look at examples like that. You can look at current day examples that are taking place in countries like China, which, again, you know, we talk so much about the trade wars that are going on, and the media seems obsessed with President Trump's trade policies. I wish they would obsess just as equally on what these other how these other countries are treating people who are religious minorities and mm-hmm. And don't enjoy the same basic freedoms that we do here in the United States.
Yeah, I know. Rob, the tax cuts, they sometimes you hear all kinds of rattling that they only help the wealthy, and that's just not right, is it?
It is not, and I'm so glad you brought this topic up because, you know, we keep hearing more and more positive economic news, and it's one of those things where it seems that the good news is happening so frequently now that it doesn't even get the attention it deserves. We at the Heritage Foundation, and we've covered this at the Daily Signal this week, have just released a report that breaks down all 435 congressional districts and the 50 states, and what we found is that in every single congressional district in every state, the average American is receiving a tax cut. And that tax cut just for 2018 totals up to $1,400, so $1,400 for the average American. Now, the thing that's unique about this study, Bill, is we are the only organization that has done at this grade of detail how people's income in the district looks and looking at their looking at 1040 returns for the district. And so the numbers are very precise based on the districts. Others have tried to do this on a district-by-district level, but I don't think you'll find as accurate information. The thing that's most exciting, though, is we looked at 10 years out because, as we know, a lot of things in Washington are done in 10-year increments to see the effect over the course of 10 years. And what we found is that the average American family is going to save $26,000 over 10 years.
Wow.
Now, you can buy a new car with that. I mean, there's an incredible amount of things that you can do with that money. And this is all because of the tax cuts that were passed by Congress and signed by the president last year. And by the way, Bill, these are the same tax cuts the Democrats now are saying that they would repeal if they gain control of Congress next year.
Well, Rob, I'm glad you're saying that because I said all of that at my Mensa meeting last night, and it went over real big.
Well, we're trying to get the word out. You know, it's one of those things where it seems that no matter how much good news there is in the world, we tend to focus on the bad things.
That's true.
That's just the natural inclination of the media. And so anytime we can share this good news, and I talked to a business owner down in Florida last week, and he just told me this incredible story. He is a diabetic. He makes sugar-free cookies. He got a start by making sugar-free ice cream. So now he's doing all sorts of sugar-free snacks, and he said he wouldn't be able to do these things, and he wouldn't be able to add to his workforce and give his employees raises if it weren't for tax reform, because he said that money that was going to the federal government to pay his taxes is now going directly into the pockets of the people who are working for him, and that is just so refreshing to hear that people are taking that attitude and hopefully leading to a better life for so many more Americans.
Yeah, that's a happy story. Rob Blue is my guest, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Rob in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. Awfully glad you're with me today. Rob Blue is my guest from Washington, D.C., my D.C. correspondent, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Rob, Jeff Sessions has brought some straight talk to some high school leadership, a summit lately. Talk about that, if you would.
He certainly has. I was with the Attorney General this morning at George Washington University, where he spoke to the Turning Point USA High School Summit, gave a fiery speech about free speech, and it's encouraging to hear a leader like Sessions talk about this topic, because it's one of those things where as students are getting ready to go back to college this fall, you can bet there's going to be a fair share of protests on college campuses. Of people that, these students might not traditionally encounter in their lives. And I think it's good that they're hearing different perspectives on college campuses. In fact, I thought that was one of the expectations for people when they did go to college. And the Attorney General has intervened in a case, one particular case at the University of Michigan, where they had biased response teams. And this is not something that I'm unfamiliar with, because my alma mater of Ithaca College did very much the same thing. They had a bias-related incidents committee that would determine what constituted biased speech on campus, and oftentimes it sometimes exceeded its authority in terms of what it was cracking down on doing. And I think the Attorney General wants to make sure that there is a distinction between having free speech, which is guaranteed under the Constitution, and the ability for people to have a conversation and a dialogue on college campuses without fearing for their own safety, as we've seen some of these protests turn pretty violent.
Mm-hmm. Rob, so as Christians, we've been forgiven much, so we have to turn around and forgive, don't we?
That's right. We certainly do, yeah.
What a great story of the fallen Navy SEAL's parents who had to forgive a teen that destroyed their son's memorial.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story that, again, we're featuring on the Daily Signal this week, and it is a touching story. You have a situation here where, you know, this 14-year-old boy was arrested in New York, charged with criminal mischief, and the memorial was broken into a dozen pieces. I mean, just a sad situation. But, you know, people have the ability, I think, thanks to, in many cases, their Christian beliefs, to forgive. And it's one of the most powerful things that we can do as fellow humans. And sometimes, Bill, people make mistakes. I made mistakes. I'm sure we all have. And to have others out there who take this attitude is an encouraging sign. And again, why I think these stories in some cases should be celebrated.
Yeah. All right, Rob. You know, the internet, as much as we love it, it's a hotbed of misinformation. And I think it was Orrin Hatch who Googled himself,
yes,
and he found that he was dead.
Yeah,
clearly he's not.
and Orrin Hatch, of course, you know, he is the the oldest U.S. senator,
right.
And he's also the Senate pro tem, which means that he's in the line of succession to become president. You know, should some terrible thing happen, I think he falls right after the Speaker of the House. So he's number four in line or something. This is one of those things where I just heard a study, and this has been, demonstrated time and time again, where Americans tend to trust information that they see on the internet more than they do from other media outlets, in part because they feel like they have the ability on their own to search and find information. Well, that's great. I'm glad that they feel that way, but they need to verify this information. The famous Reagan line, trust but verify, and
mm-hmm.
This is a classic case of where you really shouldn't believe everything that you read on the internet, particularly Wikipedia, which, sometimes people hopefully act in good faith, but other times they do act maliciously. Other times it could be a mistake, but that's why I always encourage people, don't rely on just one source of news. As much as I love hearing people saying that about the Daily Signal, I always encourage them to look for multiple sources, and hopefully not just conservative sources or liberal sources, but all sources. And I think that you can be a more well-rounded person if you do that.
Yeah. Rob, what did you think of the tweet that the president sent, the president of Iran, about don't make a mistake when it comes to the U.S. because you'll have the mother of all wars, or don't ever mess with us, all upper caps? What'd you think of that?
Well, certainly sent a message. I mean, this president does not mess around when it comes to some of the this country's adversaries. I mean, you saw that look last year with Little Rocket Man and North Korea, and
mm-hmm.
Look at the situation we're in today. I mean, the president was just boasting about the success and the talks with North Korea and the fact that we haven't had a rocket launch. So I think this is a president, in the case of Iran, who wants to send a clear message. He wants to draw a bright red line and say, if you cross this line and if you challenge the United States, you will be sorry. Now, I think that you're dealing with obviously a different situation in Iran than you were in North Korea, and that's a volatile region, and certainly the United States needs to pursue all of it, the diplomatic and efforts that it can before we engage in a conflict. But at the same time, Bill, you've seen it time and time again with this president. He is not afraid to challenge his adversaries, and this is just the latest example of that.
That is so true. When I look at some of the midterms that are coming up, and I'm thinking of this ongoing Russia investigation, which, you know, you and I have joked about for over a year now. Please let it come to an end. And I don't know if there are going to be some surprises up around the midterms that are going to be game changers, or what do you predict is going to happen with that?
Look, it's in the news again this week. I mean, we just can't get away from Russia. I thought, we had Marco Rubio speak at the Heritage Foundation last week, and we covered his speech and featured some of the clips on our podcast. And one of the things that Rubio said that really stuck out to me was that regardless of who won the presidential election in 2016, Vladimir Putin guaranteed that the United States would be focused on Russia, because if Hillary Clinton had won, there would have certainly been a situation with Russia. Donald Trump won, and we're talking about Russia. And this is exactly what Putin wants. I mean, he wants to be the center of attention. He wants to put Russia on this equal playing field with the United States, which after the Soviet Union collapsed, remember, they really weren't. Nobody was talking about them as an equal power. And so Putin was able to do that. I think that you're absolutely right. There are a number of things that could happen between August and November, which could shake up what happens when voters head to the polls. And who knows what those surprises are going to be, but that's why you and I are here, Bill, to hopefully make sense of it all and share some of our analysis with your listeners.
Well, you're the pro and the expert. I just try to set you up. When I look at someone like Elizabeth Warren, and she recently came out and said she'd like to raise the tax rate to 50%, I think, boy, if the Democrats kind of try to run on that kind of platform, they're not going to do real well.
But look, Bernie Sanders is drawing crowds for talking about giving Medicare for all, so massive expansion of entitlements, free college tuition for anybody who wants it, $15 minimum wage, which we know businesses say this is just going to be devastating for what we want to do. So there are a number of issues. You've seen a surge in the Democratic Socialists of America organization recently. You've even had candidates signing on to support and take their endorsement. So we are in a situation now where there is a tremendous amount of energy, I'd say, on both sides of the political spectrum. And there are those who are ardent supporters of President Trump, and there are those who believe we need to go in a radically different direction. And I think that in November, we're going to figure out just how it all shakes out, and it's going to be a big surprise for everyone because,
yeah.
Look, President Trump was certainly a big shock to Washington, and you can expect that this next election is going to be as well.
Yeah, 1 minute left, Rob. What are your kids doing this summer?
Well, the kids are going to a great summer camp here in the Washington area, and this week in particular, my older son is doing Explore Washington trip, so he's going to different Smithsonian museums during the day. I told him, I said, it's a shame that I can't escape from the office to come hang out with you.
No kidding.
My younger son isn't quite ready to take some of those field trips, so he's doing bike camp this week. He's learning how to swim. I mean, he's doing really well. So it's great to see them have such a great time this summer, and we're trying to dodge some of the raindrops this week to spend some quality family time together, maybe at the pool.
That's awesome. Rob, thanks so much. You're always such a great guest. I just enjoy talking to you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you, Bill.
Rob Bluey's been my guest, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com. Check it out. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
It's amazing to just see the way God cares for the little things as well as the big things, and that we can come to Him with any request.
God hears our prayers and truly cares about everything in our lives. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas. And Lauren McAfee shares how her family sees God move as they pray for each other.
I'm so grateful that I've had an example of my parents and my grandparents investing in prayer. And my grandma prays for each of us family members very specifically. And in the middle of the night, when she wakes up, she'll pray for us. And I've seen just that covering of prayer be such a blessing to me, knowing that my grandma and my parents are praying for me and encouraged me in my faith and my prayer life.
God wants you to know that He's there, and He will comfort your heart no matter what His answer is. For more ways to grow in your prayer life, click the prayer box at makingyourlifecount.com.
Welcome back to the show. It's 32 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. Colin Hanson is the editorial director for the Gospel Coalition. He has authored several books, including Young, Restless, Reformed, A Journalist's Journey with the New Calvinists, and A God-Sized Vision, Revival Stories That Stretch and Stir. He also has come out with a new book called 12 Faithful Men. He's an ambitious guy. He probably paid attention in high school, which is where we part ways. Hello, Colin. How are you?
Thanks for having me back, Bill. I'm doing well.
Of course. I bet you did pay attention in high school, didn't you?
I tried.
Yeah.
I did my best.
Were you like straight A's? Were you straight A's in high school?
Is that what this interview is about? Yeah, I was.
I figured.
I gravitated toward the English side of things. I got to say, I'm glad I don't have to deal with math or physics.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Put it that way.
But,
I wouldn't be an A today if I walked back there.
God, you know, God has given you gifts and you're using them. So that's awesome.
I'm trying.
Yeah. So your new book, 12 Faithful Men, which gives us a chance to learn from some faithful forerunners, huh?
Yeah, that's right. So here's the basic idea behind the book. So a lot of people get into ministry, especially, I think this applies to Christians all over the place, but especially to pastors. They might have gotten straight A's in high school. They might have paid attention in class, might have even gone on to graduate school. Maybe some of them even go ahead and get PhDs, like my co-editor Jeff Robinson did for this book. Then they get into ministry, and they're very eager to be able to help people, and they think they have a lot to teach them and a lot to talk about, and they think they've got a lot of wisdom that they can share, and they've learned a lot about the Bible, and then they get into it, and they're like, oh, wait a minute, this is hard, and not everybody likes me, and things are going wrong, and I don't really know what to do in this situation. And there's a crisis of faith that comes in because they think, well, I went into ministry after reading about my heroes, about Charles Spurgeon, about Jonathan Edwards, about John Calvin. I mean, what happened to me? Like, these people were all incredibly successful. And I thought I was going to be like them to a certain degree, but that's not how things turned out. Well, what we try to do in this book is to show the real story behind these faithful leaders. And the real story is not what we usually remember about them. The real story is that they were just like us. A lot of people didn't like them. A lot of people made their lives pretty difficult. They suffered in a lot of different ways. And yet they were faithful to God. And more importantly, God was faithful to them. And so that's what we're trying to do in the book.
So, Colin, maybe give me a sample of someone from the book that enjoyed a nice measure of success and a nice measure of failure.
Yeah, so I was actually just reading recently Marilynne Robinson. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author today. She lives in Iowa. She's one of the teachers at the Iowa Writers Workshop. She's one of President Obama's favorite writers. In fact, she's a favorite writer of many in the Gospel Coalition because she wrote a trilogy of books about small-town Iowa and a pastor. It's the Gilead series. Anyway, she was talking recently with Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention, and she said, well, we all know that Jonathan Edwards was the greatest thinker in American history. Okay, well, maybe people do remember something about Jonathan Edwards from those long-ago high school classes, those English anthologies where you might have read something like his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, or perhaps followed through with any number of other different things. So he's well-known in the mid-1700s. He went on to be president of Princeton, but never actually took the job because he died right before that was supposed to happen. But essentially, I mean, he's widely acclaimed. Yale University puts out just, you know, dozens of volumes of his collected works, an amazing person. And he was fired. He was fired by his church, a church that he made world famous because he wrote about the amazing revival. This is part of what we call the First Great Awakening or the Great Awakening. He was the main leader in that, along with George Whitefield. He wrote all about it. We still study, you mentioned the God-Sized Vision, that book that I worked on and published in 2010. A lot of that was based on his work. And so a very famous figure, and yet the people of his community found him to be rather overbearing, somewhat obnoxious in some ways, maybe not personable enough, and they got rid of him. They chased him out of town. This is a town where he and his wife had profitably ministered for many years. They had many, many, many children, as so many did back in colonial America, and they had to uproot all of them, and they had to take them off to work among Native Americans at a place called Stockbridge. Basically, just imagine somewhere that is in the middle of nowhere on the frontier, wherever that is for you. That's what it was like for them back then in colonial Massachusetts. And that's actually where he did a lot of his most fruitful writing later in his career. But it was a far cry from this guy who had been a prodigy going through Yale, had gone, his grandfather had been one of the most famous preachers in the history of colonial America, and yet he had to endure this indignity of having been fired. It's interesting that another person that a lot of people look up to, John Calvin, one of the great reformers of the 16th century, his situation is not totally dissimilar. When the Reformation came there to Geneva in Switzerland, John Calvin and one of his companions, Guillaume Farel, were also themselves chased out of town by people who didn't want what they were saying. And I think there's a reason we start off the whole book by looking at the Apostle Paul, because the Apostle Paul, you know, when he was talking about his ministerial credentials, like what qualifies a man to be able to serve God, to minister his word, to lead his people. And when Paul says that, he says it's the sufferings that he's endured. It's not his brilliance, though Paul was perhaps the most brilliant man of his day, trained at the highest levels. But in fact, it was his very sufferings that made him to do that. So what we're trying to affect here is a significant change in people's perceptions of what it means to be, quote unquote, successful as a Christian and as a pastor in particular.
Colin, this is really eye-opening because I listen to these stories, and maybe I'm just not familiar with the histories of these men, and they got they were so influential, and then they get fired. That's shocking.
Well, John Bunyan, perhaps many of the listeners have read Pilgrim's Progress, probably the most read English language book outside of Bible translations, originally in English language. I mean, he wrote that in prison. But we read a Bible, some of which was written in prison, specifically, say, for example, the letter to the Philippians from the Apostle Paul. So it's not as surprising as we actually might think. Charles Spurgeon, again, the Prince of Preachers, we call him. Well, the beginning of his ministry was characterized by a horrible situation where more or less a stampede broke out due to, there's a reason why they talk about not yelling fire in a movie theater. That's effectively what happened, and people died. They got trampled while he was preaching, and this led him to a pretty severe depression that he struggled with for much of his life, of feelings of guilt that really beset him. He also had major problems because he was significantly overweight, and in the mid-18th century or 19th century, there just wasn't a ton that they really knew what to do about that. And then also later in his life, his own brother and many of his students abandoned him, thinking he was something of a relic and that he was a curmudgeon, that he complained too much about theological drift toward liberalism in his denomination. Well, the reality is, it turns out he was right about all of that. Many of these people would fall away from the faith, and this Baptist Union would decline in what people would call the downgrade controversy of Great Britain in the mid to late 19th century. So we remember Spurgeon as just this incredible preacher. He was so popular in Queen Victoria's era, the first ever megachurch pastor. We want to, who are the Spurgeons of our own day? Well, if you want to see who the Spurgeons of our own day, perhaps look at those people who are struggling with depression, who are struggling with feelings of guilt, who are dealing with health problems and weight problems, and who are facing opposition from their closest friends and family and former students, because that's who Charles Spurgeon was.
Wow, Colin Hanson, say more interesting things.
Well, there's another...
I'm just taking notes. Kinds. This is fascinating.
Well, there's a couple other interesting ones. We really tried to do in the book is in compiling these stories of 12 faithful men, we tried to get a diverse collection of voices. We wanted different times. We wanted different places. We wanted different ethnicities. We wanted different denominations. So I think a lot of people can relate to this. I'll give you another one here. Wang Mendao is from the 20th century, kind of post-war period in China. So if you think about the incredible growth, unprecedented growth of the church in China, probably, you know, we'll see what happens in 20 years or 50 years or 100 years, but it looks like China's church really is going to carry a lot of the future of Christianity around the world. Well, Wang Mendao is known as the father of the house church movement. Well, the house church movement is a house church movement precisely because they broke off from the state church. The communists were fine with having this kind of official Protestant church as long as the church knew its role. Its role was to not do anything that would make the communist government unhappy. Well, Wang Mendao wasn't going to put up with that. He opposed that Protestant church, that official state church, and again, I said, was the father of the house churches. Well, but the communist government just went after him, and they made his life miserable, as you might imagine, and so did the Christian leaders of the state church. Well, at one point, they decided to put him in prison, and they'll let him out on one condition. All he has to do is swear allegiance to the Protestant official church and therefore to the communist government. No big deal. So he does it. He gets out of prison and realizes it's the equivalent of abandoning his faith, the equivalent of betraying Jesus. And he says, I can't do it. There's no way I can do this. So he goes back into prison for another decade. I mean, imagine doing that, just knowing the rack in your brain thinking, I've got a wife to care for. I have children to care for, a flock to be able to pastor. What do I do in this situation? Well, we remember him as one of the greatest leaders, but he faced this incredible challenge and was just racked with this guilt because he felt like he had betrayed his core principles and he suffered a great deal for it.
I wish I would have paid attention in high school like Colin Hanson. Colin, let me take a break. Lots more when I come back, talking about 12 Faithful Men, written by Colin Hanson. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Is on the 46. I'm speaking to Colin Hanson. He's my guest on our studio line. He has written several books. The one we're talking about today is called 12 Faithful Men, and we're learning about the successes and failures and testimonies of the faithful who've gone before us. Colin, why are these stories so important?
Well, in part because we just don't know them.
That's a great point.
We develop a distorted perspective on history, and with a distorted perspective on history, we have a distorted perspective on our own circumstances. I've been reading and rereading James 1 lately, and right off the bat, we learn that we are not to consider it strange when we endure many trials. And we go back to the words of James' brother Jesus, and we go back and we say, what did Jesus tell us? He told us to expect that we would suffer many things on account of his name, that we would be slandered, that we would be persecuted on account of our faith. But that's pretty difficult for people who have the kind of unprecedented comfort that we have in 21st century America. And that's not to belittle the many, many real things that we all suffer from day to day, physical and mental and otherwise. But it's just to say we have privileges that the people that we write about in this book just never could have dreamed of before. And so sometimes it means that we can lose touch with reality. We lose touch with the truth that this is normal in the Christian life. And in fact, it's consistently shown to us to be actually a means by which God sanctifies us. He makes us more like Jesus, and it's a way of testing to prove the genuineness of our faith. And there's simply no figure. I mean, we could go back together through every single biblical figure that we could think of here, and you wouldn't be able to find any great leader who about whom it could not be said that, on the one hand, he was a man who was a sinner. We know that about King David. We know that about Moses. We could go on and on and on. Apart from Jesus, everybody else was a sinner. Read about it in the Bible. And then at the same time, something that's true also of Jesus, along with every other leader, is that they suffered many things simply by living here in a fallen world. They suffered from the abandonment of their friends or the accusations of their enemies. I try to read the Psalms every day, about five of them or so. And it's just very calibrating to me because I'm able to see, oh, yes, like these hardships are normal in life. And it, to me, it's not a real morbid thought. It's not something that discourages me. It actually encourages me to say that if God has preserved all of these great people of faith throughout history, well, the same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the same God who lives and reigns today and has sent his Holy Spirit to preserve us and to protect us. And so, oddly enough, these stories they're important because they encourage us even through the difficulty of them.
I agree. And so, Colin, are church leaders and pastors, are they facing different challenges than previous generations, or is it kind of the same problems just in a newer package?
So here's one of the most difficult things about pastoral ministry, and I'm not sure how many of us actually stop and think this through. So think about the Apostle Paul's example. One of the things he does is he makes tents. In part, that's so that he doesn't have to rely on people, many of whom are suffering and don't have a lot of discretionary income to be able to support him. He actually supports a paid ministry. We see that very clearly, especially in his writings to Titus and to Timothy. But you know that Paul himself did not want to be essentially beholden to anyone. Well, think about this. A lot of the Bible that our ministers teach to us is filled with things that we don't necessarily want to hear. There are things that make us uncomfortable. There are things that upset us sometimes in our sin. There are things that are very complicated. They're very countercultural at the very least. So it's quite confusing for us. Well, imagine that somebody has been charged to be able to be our leader, or a group of people have been charged to be our leaders, and their job is to stand up every week and to tell us things that we don't necessarily want to hear. Now, there are many encouraging parts of the Bible as well that we would recognize and give, automatic thanks for, but that's not the full counsel of Scripture. So you don't have a pastor here who wants to stick just to the passages of Scripture that might make people feel a certain way. He's trying to really fulfill his responsibility here. Well, just imagine that. How are you supposed to tell people things that they don't want to hear when those are the people who pay your salary?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who ensure that your kids get to have swimming lessons and have food on the table, and those are the ones who are friends with your wife. And, it's a hard situation that's pretty basic, but I don't think a lot of people really stop and think about there. So every time a pastor preaches or teaches or counsels, there's this little thing that says, I don't really know exactly how to do this, if I'm going to be honest here about God's word, with people who I know, even by faith and by the power of the Holy Spirit, are sometimes going to be resistant to God's truth. And that's just a basic dilemma that pastors of every age have faced, but maybe also in a time of itching ears like we have today, where a lot of people go to church because they need a little bit of a pick-me-up.
Mm-hmm.
They need a little bit of an emotional boost in the week, and that's not altogether bad. But if that's what you expect from Scripture purely in those terms, man, there's going to be a lot that you just don't want to have to hear. And that puts the pastor in a bit of a difficult situation.
Yeah, Colin, which of the stories that you researched hit you most squarely in the breadbox?
Yeah, that's got to be the one about Jenani Luam. A lot of people have not heard of him before, and that's one reason why we wanted to include him. I work out of a Beeson Divinity School in Birmingham, Alabama, and we actually have a bust from him a sculpture of him in our chapel. We actually have busts of four different martyrs from the 20th century. So one that I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of before is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But not a lot of people know about Janani Luwum. He was in Uganda. Many people maybe have even taken mission trips to Uganda. It's known as a very, I don't know if I'd say overwhelmingly, but a very thoroughly Christian nation. It's different kinds of Christianity, a lot of prosperity theology there as well. But you know, it's a vibrant kind of a Christian nation today in Africa, in East Africa. In fact, in A God-Sized Vision, that book, again, I write a lot about the East African revivals of places like Rwanda and Uganda in the early 20th century. Well, maybe if people have not heard of Luwum before, somebody, especially some of the older listeners, have probably heard of Idi Amin.
Oh, yeah.
Idi Amin is one of the most notorious and evil dictators of the 20th century. Well, Luwum was the Anglican archbishop, you know, the equivalent of the Episcopal Church in the United States, but he was an Orthodox, faithful Anglican bishop of the church in Uganda, and he spoke out against Idi Amin. Idi Amin had warned him not to do this. He understood the situation. Luwum understood the situation there, and Luwum was eventually executed for his faith, for standing up and opposing Idi Amin. His story is one of not everybody that we talk about in the book. In fact, I think he's the only martyr other than the Apostle Paul that we talk about. But interesting, we don't really know exactly what happened with Paul, but we do understand generally that he was martyred. But Luwum's the only one that we know of that whose life ends that way, and that's the ultimate kind of path of Jesus there, and not one that I'd expect many of the rest of us to have to go through. But it does just really hit you hard there as you read about somebody paying the ultimate price for speaking the truth of God to somebody who, now, in retrospect, we all recognize was just an absolutely evil figure.
Mm-hmm. Colin, what are some potential takeaways from your book? Obviously, we're going to feel encouraged to hear that there is persecution if you're going to be out sharing your faith. And some of the greatest evangelists ever suffered lots of persecution. So that's helpful for us to know. But I mean, it's a good reminder. What are some other potential takeaways?
I think mainly overall, Bill, it's that difficulties can arise from all kinds of different places. It's not going to look the same in each situation, and that's the diversity of our dynamics here. So you have governments that were opposed to them in both Wang Mendao and Janani Luwum's cases. One of them ends up in martyrdom. Both of them end up in jail. But Wang Mendao is, you know, his situation ends up differently. It can come in the form of theological mockery or abuse, basically being hostile toward our faith. That would be the situation of Charles Simeon. He was in a university town, Cambridge, and was widely reviled by people who regarded him to be a kind of backward figure who taught too much of the Bible, was too conservative. John Newton, many people will remember him as the author of Amazing Grace. He struggled in some similar ways as an evangelical within a broadly kind of liberal atmosphere within the Church of England, reviled there as an evangelical. So I think just the takeaways are it can come from within, the depression and the doubt and the health problems that we struggle with. Theological opposition can come from government opposition. And, you know, sometimes we bring these things upon ourselves in ministry as well. Sometimes we provoke the wrong people for the wrong reasons because we ourselves are not above sin. And so sometimes that intrudes as well. So you might think about somebody like Calvin or Edwards, who at various points in their life were more heavy-handed in their teaching, perhaps a little bit removed from the people in their haughty attitudes. So it can really come from a variety of different sources, but the point is all of us, no matter who we are, we share this in common because, you know, my dad is a farmer and my mom's a teacher, and I know the hardships that they went through in their jobs. And that always helps me to just understand. I think it's helpful for pastors, especially to remember everybody is struggling in a different way.
Yeah.
Everybody has a hard time in their jobs, and it calls us to really extend a lot of grace to each other.
Colin, you're a fine man and a great resource. I wish you lived here in town. You could help me move my sleeper sofa.
I was glad to do it, Bill.
You can go to thegospelcoalition.org to find out more about Colin Hanson, and certainly check out his book, 12 Faithful Men, available at any bookstore. Thanks so much, Colin. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Yep, talk to you next time. Colin Hanson, once again, is my guest. We'll take a short break and be back with more. We've got Dr. Larry Crabb coming up in all of Hour 2. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.